Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Just wanted to mention that the traffic of likes on the JBL Facebook page have increased the last couple of weeks. And I just wanted to tell everyone out there, thanks for that. And the same goes for SoundCloud. Thanks for that, too. So this means that our listeners are really enjoying H's for Hawk. And I'm really glad you are. It's kind of fun for me and exciting to be hosting a program like this. But I do want you to remember, we will begin discussion of The Piano Shop on the Left Bank, and that is by Thad Carhart, at the end of March. Now, if you have not yet purchased your copy of this book, I just looked on abebooks.com before coming up here. You can find them for $3.48, no shipping charge. So it's really just a minimal investment. And if you don't know much about this book, I'll give you just a little bit of a preview. It is a unique look at France, and it's also about friendship, but it's also about the author's renewed passion for the piano. So I think it's going to be a good cultural study. And remember, this is our Around This World series in books. So we've done England, now we're going to do France, and then we do have a couple other ones we're thinking of, maybe one on China, one certainly related maybe to Afghanistan. And so we'll just see where we go with all that. I have to read them first before I recommend them. That's the problem. Okay, so today with me in the studio are my very good friend and brother in literature. Daryl Hope is here. And my very intelligent and beautiful wife, Deborah Leap, is also here. So greetings to you both, and welcome back to JBL.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's so good to hear. Well, what I thought we'd do today is just give our listeners some of our final thoughts on Helen MacDonald's best-selling memoir, H is for Hawk. And we do have to remember, I think it is a memoir. And there's several things that I would like to cover, but Daryl, I want you to go first because you're just so glib. It's just so great to have you here. But before you do that, I just wanted to mention something to our listeners out there that I've been kind of reading and going back and rereading and studying some things in the book. And one thing, if you remember what Derry said a couple programs ago, maybe just last program, that he was talking about the title, it's so unique, it's H is for Hawk, and he really talks about Helen MacDonald and how she almost becomes no person. You know, she has almost no personality. And then, but as you get through the book, it's almost she really obsessively over-identifies with the hawk. And so, but there is, he suggested in the title that H means Helen is for Hawk. Well, I found another part in the book, and I don't know if this is really what she intended, but she does something in the book, and she had to get the publisher to agree to this. So I do think she is really trying to tell us that she is Helen, and not only is she Helen for the Hawk, or H is for Hawk, I think she's Helen Hawk. And so I want to show you where I think I can prove this. So this is on page 128. I know someone wrote me, and I do apologize that we've been talking about the book and not giving the pages. So we'll try and do that. But if you remember, this comes after the scene when she's flying the goshawk at the college. And it's really, I mean, there's not enough time to talk about every scene in the book, but it's just absolutely hilarious. She's trying to fly the hawk, and you have these pheasants come out. And, of course, a hawk is going to go after a pheasant, and then she's trying to hold on to the hawk and not have the pheasants, like, slaughtered in front of her. And these are the baby pheasants. And so, but the master at the college invites her over for dinner, and then the master's wife invites her over for a private tea with her family, and she wants her to bring the hawk so that her children can get a good view of this hawk. And I'll just break into the middle of the page. It says, the master's wife says, or Helen's talking to the master's wife, and she says, "We talked for a while under tattered leaf shadows, and soon I was in the kitchen in the master's lodge drinking tea. So, Helen," she said, "we're having a lunch party on Saturday, just family, in the garden, if the weather's fine. What would be marvelous," she said, head tilted, "would be if you came along afterwards and brought your hawk. We have heard you're flying her on the college grounds, and we'd love to meet her." She uncapped a black marker pen and wrote, "Helen Goshawk," on a whiteboard, then hesitated, turned to me, "2 p.m.?" And she answers, "2 p.m. So what's interesting in the book, if you're on that page, again, it's page 128, it doesn't say Helen / Goshawk. It's in all capital letters, like it's a name, Helen Goshawk. And so I just think, Derry, that you were onto something there. And I'd almost like to write her personally. I don't know if we could ever get her on an interview, but I would like to write her personally and say, okay, is this what you're really intending here?
Right.
So, okay, now I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, it's just interesting, following up what you said on page 128, if you look on page 129, at the bottom of page 129, this is where she's actually talking with, she's at a luncheon, and she says, "I used to be a research fellow, a proper academic. Now I'm in Motley. I am not Helen anymore. I am the Hawk Woman." So even people around her see her as the Hawk Woman. So she starts to see herself that way as well. And then that metamorphosis takes place, I think, as we go through the book. what I'd like to say about this book is that it is positive in some aspects. And there are some things about it that are very interesting. One of the things that I think is positive is really just to see how someone copes with grief. Because that really is what this book is a lot of about someone coping with grief and how they go through that and how they work through that. In fact, the Guardian newspaper calls this the misery memoir. And it's really about the misery that she's really
a good way to describe it, the misery memoir.
Right, and she actually reacted to that. And she said, yes, it is a misery memoir because that's how people are when they go through a terrible event. And so she really sort of sees it that way herself. But given the fact that it is a misery memoir, it's not going to be one you're going to be laughing at as you read. It's sort of somber in that way, but it does have very good descriptions. There are some great descriptions of her scenes out with the hawk and doing the hunting. Those are things that will stand out in your mind. There is a deftness that she has, an easiness about moving between these three streams of consciousness that she uses to lay out the book. One is, of course, her own delvings with her and the hawk, her father, and the musings about her father, and then her talking and musings about T.H. White. So she really does have these three streams of consciousness throughout the book, and she moves between them very easily in ways that sometimes you don't even realize that she's moving from one to the other, which makes it very interesting. and I think it's also interesting because this is a grief memoir. The way she deals with grief is that she doesn't sit and describe it. She actually lives it, and you see it through her behavior and how other people react to her and how she reacts to situations and how she reacts to her environment. She doesn't write, "Oh, I'm so grieved and I'm so unhappy." But you see that in the way she reacts to things and situations, and that's very well done. As a writer, she does that very well, and it's something interesting to look as you get to the book. I would think that one thing, H is for hawk, but H is not for hope. because that's the one thing about this book, yeah, is that if you look at it, there's no hope in the book. Mm-hmm. There is, musings about her father, then about her and the hawk, which is in the present. So she talks about the present, and she talks about the immediate and then the less immediate past. But there's nothing about the future. There's nothing really future-oriented about it. And I think that's sort of the dimension that makes you feel like this sort of sense of, well, is that all there is? Just I feed the hawk and I kill a rabbit and give it to her, you know. So there's sort of this sense of a blackness, which I think it is typical of grief, you know, that right. there is sort of a loss of hope, and you sense that in the book.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. I've been kind of intimating as I've read through the book. It's fascinating to me because, one, I have read, there's a great book about Abraham Lincoln, and it's Abraham Lincoln's Depression. And, you know, Abraham Lincoln was a great president, but he suffered terrible bouts of depression. There's another interesting book. It's a series of writings by people that have been depressed, and it's called Ghost Stories, and it's about people that are depressed. And it just seems like when a person gets into depression, they just get locked in a certain blackness.
Right.
And so when you talk about how she moves through things and how it's excellent descriptions of how she is. She doesn't come out and say, I was just this or that, but she does communicate it very well. You can feel, mm-hmm. right. by the way she writes, you can feel essentially how a depressed person feels. And it is really kind of remarkable writing that way. And like I said, this isn't necessarily the best entertainment. If you want to just sit down and read a book for entertainment, this right. is not it. There is, as you've said before, if you're interested in falconry, there is a lot of interesting detail in there that if you're really wanting to go out and train a hawk, these are some of the things that would help you. But above all, I think we have to look at this book. This is a memoir of a troubled person.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I do think there's a positive payout at the end because she does come out of it. But it is interesting. If you talk to anybody that goes through depression, it always sneaks up on you. And then there's one part of the book where she says that she, if you remember, she's with Stuart, who is kind of like a senior falconer. And if you remember, Mabel is a little too fat, and she's not flying right, and she can't hit the arm right, and she's right. falling on the ground. And Stuart is there saying, and of course. Helen is blaming herself. This is all her fault. You know, she can't do anything right. Well, that's typical of depressed people as well. It's just not true. I mean, she's an accomplished writer. She's an accomplished historical or history scholar from Cambridge. I mean, I'd like to go to Cambridge for a few weeks. I'd be happy, you know. when she's talking to Stuart, then as they're trying to figure out what's wrong with the hawk, it's not her at all. It's the hawk. The hawk's too heavy, mm-hmm. and it can't fly right. But she says to him, I think I'm depressed.
Right.
And he says, no, it's the hawk is the problem. But actually, she is depressed. Mm-hmm. And she sees the hawk through those eyes.
Right.
So,
right. And it's interesting, too, I just noticed this recently, looking at the book, it's divided into two parts. And it's interesting where she divides it. She divides it once at the section where she starts to let go of the hawk. So it's almost that, you know, this first part of her life is all this reminiscing on the past and getting ready for the hawk and everything. And then the second part is where she starts to let go. Mm-hmm. And she lets the hawk go, and she starts to let go of some of this grief. And it's almost if that's hidden in the way that structured the book is structured.
Mm-hmm.
But interesting read, an interesting mm-hmm. book. As you say, it's not a book that's entertaining to read necessarily, but it's one that's very informative.
Exactly. And I think if you're into analyzing writing, which, you know, that's my job. I have to analyze writing. If you're into analyzing writing, or, you know, like if you want to see how a writer puts things together to describe things, it's an excellent book for that.
Yes.
It's really good for that. Okay, Deborah.
Well, yeah.
I'm going to let you take the mic.
Well, in terms of what you've been talking about, the descriptions, I think it's interesting is the descriptions are very vivid, and they actually lead you to understand how she's feeling, because she talks about the light, you know, on different days, and it's depending on how she's feeling, it's different. Like on page 208, this is where she's still feeling kind of bad. Let's see, page 208, and towards the top of the page of that first big paragraph, I mean, where it's it kind of there's a break and says, "White air and aching bones." It's almost like to me, just like that. It just to me, there's a description of how she's feeling. Then another migraine, and then she says, "I swallow a dose of codeine and I don't know how to pronounce that. Anyway, but my head still hurts. But just the white air and the aching bones to me is very descriptive, and it's talking about how she's feeling. And she says she doesn't really even want to go fly the goshawk, but she knows she needs to. And I'm finding it so hard to move that secretly I'm hoping that the hawk's weight is wrong or the weather is. I have no excuse to stay in bed this time. Both hawk and weather are fine. So she's really combating, she's really depressed and she doesn't want to get out of bed, but she does it because of the hawk. But I just thought that was an interesting description there.
I think that's really a good thing to bring out, because when a person does go into depression, they do need to have encouragement to get out and do things. Sometimes, you know, a depressed person will just think they can't do anything. They just don't have any energy. They don't have, but it seems like that she uses she doesn't have anybody else. They think she's just grieving over her father. They don't see the depression. And I see the grief as one point and the depression as a second point. That there's actually two things affecting her. One, her father is just a trigger. I think there are deeper things in there that this all triggers. But instead of finding that person that could help her, it's actually the bird that helps her.
Yes.
You know, she says, "Oh, I've got to do this for the bird." Mm-hmm. And generally when a person is depressed, they get so selfish, they can't think of anything but themselves. So it's really that gives her like glimmer of hope, or, you know, there's a little bit of light there where she will, you know, she'll say, "Well, I need to do this for the hawk." I mean, she had herself pretty much locked up in her house until she realized, "I need to take this hawk out."
It seemed like that was how she started healing, was doing more of that. But in the process of really going out and training the hawk, then she actually, at one point she says, "I turned myself into a hawk." That's a page 211. So at the bottom she says, I turned myself into a hawk, taken all the traits of goshawks in the books and made them my own. I was nervous, highly strung, paranoid, prone to fits of terror and rage. I ate greedily or didn't eat at all. I fled from society, hid from everything, found myself drifting into strange states where I wasn't certain who or what I was. Okay, so, and it says, in hunting with Mabel day after day, I had assumed, in my imagination, of course, but that was all could ever be, her alien perspective, her inhuman understanding of the world. And so she felt like she was turning into the hawk. At least she was identifying so much of the hawk that she actually became, at one point she talks about being an outsider. You know, she really was, really alienated herself from the world. She was in the world of the hawk, and basically as an animal and the bird. But during that process, it did help her. Then I think it's interesting to see how she changes. So I just want to keep on going.
Oh,
with
absolutely,
that.
Yes.
Yeah. Then on page 232 is where you see a difference, and she's talking about going out again with Mabel, and she says the middle of page 232. She describes the flocks of field fares. I don't really know what those are. Check and dodge in the hawthorns by the cow field. And she talks about something, thrushy strobes of black and white, and it's nice to see them. So she likes what she's seeing. And then she says, "Proper winter is here, and Mabel is fizzing with happiness, wagging her tail in barely suppressed excitement, tummy feathers fluffed over her grippy toes, eyes gleaming silver in the sun. If this hawk could speak, she'd be singing under her breath. Something has changed inside me. Today, it's hard to slip into the exquisite, worldless sharpness of being a hawk. Or rather, the hawk seems more human today." So she's changed. She says, "Something's changed inside me." And she can't just get into that wordless feeling of being the hawk. So I see this as a change in her at this point. So that's a positive thing. And then then the last chapter, I think, is a nice chapter where it's positive. Like Derry said, there isn't really hope in this book, but you get a sense of peace at the end. You know that she's at peace, and where she really talks about how the hawk is well. Let me explain about there is a I like this description where she had to let the hawk get fat because it was time for her
to molt
and grow new plumage. So she had to feed it and let it be fat, because for goshawks to really stay, according to all the training manuals, you needed to have a goshawk be a certain weight, not too heavy, so they would come back to you, or else they would go wild. Well, she let her hawk get really fat because she needed to be fat for the plumage. And she says, she's round as a turkey now, and part of me has been waiting for her to get wild. A fat goshawk is a wild goshawk, say the books. They are wrong. Of course they are. Mabel's less willing to tolerate strangers in this fed-up state, but she's still as tame as a kitten with me. This morning we played throw and catch with paper balls, and for the last hour she's been snoozing on my fist while I watched bad TV. So it's really a very domestic, you know, scene here, and they're buddies, really. And but then she goes through an earthquake, and it scares her, terrorizes her. Actually, she wakes up to an earthquake, and she goes down to see Mabel. She's afraid that Mabel will be really upset, but she's...
If I could interrupt you with that, that is probably one of the most intense scenes, I think, in the book, because it's with depressed people. I mean, there is, like I said, there can be physical sides, but I also know there can be spiritual sides. And so when the bed's shaking and she, the way she writes it, you think, is there like this ghost in the room, or maybe I should really say demon in the room, because I think there is there are evil spirits in this world that are very negative themselves. And I think they feed on someone that is depressed. They can work through that. So if you'd like to read a few sections of that, that would be great. If you just, if you wanted to read from the beginning there, I think we are going to let, by the way, for all the listeners out there, we are going to let this program go a little longer today. We have time for it. So this will be a little bit more than your normal 25 minutes. So go ahead and just read that section. I think that's great.
Well, so like after when she
just goes, read from the beginning there, and when she talks about she falls into the dream and all that.
Okay, are you talking about the bottom of 276?
About the earthquake, yeah. The movie.
Okay, some things are too terrifying to comprehend. Seconds can pass in disbelief as the world you live in turns into a lie, and just past 1 a.m, I'm having one of the worst nightmares of my life. My dreams lately have been small and full of light, but in this one, someone, something, for it cannot be human, has taken hold of the end of my bed and is shaking it hard, trying to pitch me to the floor. It is the feeling in the dream that terrifies me most of all. It is not like a nightmare, it is worse. I wake with a start. Something is still shaking my bed. I can see it move, hear it creaking. There is no one in the room. Every inch of my skin crawls with terror. I am shaking and unable to move.
Yeah, my skin crawled when I was reading it.
The wrongness is indescribable. The fear is falling through 1,000 feet of air. The bed is still shaking, senselessly, violently, horribly, impossibly. Then it stops. For a few seconds, I lie there stricken. I have not been breathing, I realize. I take a vast gulp of shuddering air. The lampshade above me is swinging in circles still. Then a flash of understanding, an earthquake. It was an earthquake here in England. They hardly ever happen here, do they? Was it definitely an earthquake? It must have been. So you keep on reading.
Yeah, okay. Yes, we have time.
Okay. Yes, I still can't quite believe it. I jump out of bed and peer through the curtains. Lights are on in all the houses. People in the street are wandering fearfully in pajamas. The phone rings and I pick it up, and it is Christina. Earthquake, she yells. Did you feel it? I swear, she curses. Ordinary words fail us. We mouth obscenities in the cause of reassurance, but they are not enough. When I put the phone down, I cannot calm myself. I put my hands out flat in front of me, palms down. They are still shaking. Stop freaking out, Helen, I tell myself. It's okay. Nothing is broken. Everything is fine. but it is not. The earthquake has brought back all those childhood fears of apocalypse, all the expectation that the world would burn and boil. It is a very old, deep terror, and it feels now that it has never gone away. The fabric of the world has torn. I cannot stitch it back together, and then I remember Mabel. I've heard all the stories about animals fleeing from earthquakes. She must be terrified. I race downstairs, three steps at a time, burst through the door, and turn on the light in her room. She is asleep. She wakes, pulls her head from her mantle feathers, and looks at me with clear eyes. She's surprised to see me. She yawns, showing her pink mouth like a cat's, and its arrowhead tongue with its black tip. Her creamy underparts are draped right down over her feet, so only one lemony toe and one carbon black talon are exposed. Her other foot is drawn up high at her chest. She felt the tremors, and then she went back to sleep, entirely unmoved by the moving earth. The quake brought no panic, no fear, no sense of wrongness to her at all. She's at home in the world. She's here. She ducks her head upside down, pleased to see me, shakes her feathers into a fluffy mop of contentment, and then as I sit with her, she slowly closes her eyes, tucks her head back into her feathers, and sleeps. She is not a duke, a cardinal, a hieroglyph, or a mythological beast, but right now, Mabel is more than a hawk. She feels like a protecting spirit. My little household god, some things happen only once, twice in a lifetime. The world is full of signs and wonders that come and go, and if you are lucky, you might be alive to see them. I had thought the world was ending, but my hawk had saved me again, and all the terror was gone.
Yes, mm-hmm. To me, that's a great sample of her great writing. Mm-hmm,
it is,
but being a writer myself, she had to plan that whole section out. That didn't take her 5 minutes, just to plan that out. But she builds the intensity, and I think she wants you to think there's a demon
that's
in the
right.
room, mm-hmm. But I do think it's interesting that she's able to kind of bring out her childhood fears. And I remember as a boy that my mother, I had a brother in Vietnam and I had another brother in Germany. It was a very difficult time in the United States. And my mother used to watch these World War II films of the Germans and the Nazis and you know, how they were the bootstepping, and there was like all this fear, and then you see this death, dead bodies laying around. And I used to have these horrible nightmares at night, and I could even see the German signs that like it's verboten, and it's like, but the thing is in some ways it's really sad. I think it's interesting that she brings up, the apocalypse, and she brings up things about the end of the world, and really, I think everyone knows we're here at Herbert W. Armstrong College, and there is, we do have a certain Bible belief that we do know the world is going to end, but it's not the world; it's an age, and the earth is not going to end in this fire. There's going to be trouble. Well, eventually, it's going to end in fire, but there's going to be all this trouble for a while. But then, The Bible says that Christ is going to come back and start a new world. And so all those fears are based on deceit. People are deceived. And I grew up in a religion where you didn't even read the Bible. So I didn't learn about these things till I was in 19 and 20. I mean, a lot of these religious concepts I didn't even understand. So I think there is a part of the book, if we go through that, is she does communicate. And whether she intended to or not, she does indicate how misconception or misperception can really, really mess up your life. I mean, even as simple with the bird. Remember, the bird was too heavy, and the bird had the problem with it. It couldn't have the right flying weight. It couldn't navigate well because it was too heavy, and she had gotten it wrong. She says, "I got the weights wrong," and of course, Stuart helps her to see that she got the weights wrong. And she was taking all this burden on herself that was her fault. It was her fault that she couldn't do it. The poor bird was suffering because of her. But really, there was a miscalculation, mm-hmm. And somewhere, I think, in her, with many people, she had a close relationship with her father. She had a close relationship with her mother. she had a close relationship with her brother, but still, you know, there still wasn't the deep understanding of the purpose of life and the meaning of life and, you know, why are we even here? Now, of course, we know she obviously believes in evolution because she calls the bird a raptor. And, you know, she talks about it being serpentine, like, you know, these birds evolved from serpents and dragons and things like that. So, as our one of our commenters said, it's when you know the truth. There is a truth. There's an absolute truth about creation and why there is an earth and why we have things like goshawks. But so many people in this world don't know those things. And they do end up getting depressed, and they do miscalculate, and they make decisions because they don't have the truth. And so you can see that in this book, and I think she did begin to realize, as I heard on the radio interviews, she was miscalculating certain things, and it was making her situation worse. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think it's just kind of fascinating myself. So you can still make more comments, don't.
Well, I think what's a little bit sad from our standpoint, too, is to look at it. And she talks in this section that you read, Ms. Leap, about the fact that she really sees this hawk as her protecting spirit, mm-hmm. and the hawk has saved her again. Mm-hmm. And you can understand why humanly she's gone there, mm-hmm. because she's trying to find an answer to her grief and her depression. And she finds it to some degree through this hawk, but it's sad that she has to go there to look for it. You know,
right.
It's a sad thing.
Right. And she has to go to something physical.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing, and we're not condemning her for this. Mm-hmm. It's just there's nothing spiritual there. I mean, I think she tries. I mean, she talks a little bit about mythology. She calls her house god and, you know, things like that. So there are a lot of people in this world that do like religious thinking. They do like religious talk. But that doesn't mean it's the truth, you know. And it's really, even as the Bible does say, and Christ said it, it's the truth that sets you free, you know. And so that's where my take on depression is if there is a spiritual side to it as well, mm-hmm. and if you know the truth, that's what sets you free from depression. You know, there is all human beings are flawed, everyone fails, but if you're let's say right with God, you can still have success, and that's where the people in the world just kind of miss that. And so that's what I said, this is kind of I look at the whole book as a study in human nature, but it's still fascinating to me anyway. So was that it? You're done with yours? Okay. I just wanted to say that there is some humorous things in the book. And if we go to page 137, this is where she's flying. She's flying Mabel at the college. And this is where she runs into the moorhens and the pheasants. And, you know, you've got this. And I imagine that Mabel was pretty big. And she's pretty mm-hmm. terrifying. And as she says, at the top of page 137, we'll skip around a little bit. It says, the next day, a plague of moorhens had come out of the messy copse behind the pavilion and were running all over the pitch. And for those of us who are Americans, it's like the field. It's like you can have a soccer pitch, you know, so it's like a soccer field. So that's what the English word pitch is. It says the pitch like a flock of feathered black mice, moorhens, birds that can neither fly well nor run fast. They are such easy prey for goshawks that falconers avoid flying them out of a sense of sporting fair play. So she is humorous. I mean, there's some humorous sections here. Mabel had never seen them. Mabel had never seen them before, but she looked upon them now as if they had been designed by a kindly deity for her personal delectation. I wasn't surprised. I'd already discovered that all sorts of predatory taxonomies are buried in a baby goshawk's brain. A few days earlier, I'd seen her looking at a small drawing of partridges in a book I'd left open on the floor. Intrigued, I picked up the book and held it in front of her. She kept her eyes fixed on the picture, even when I moved the book about in the air. No way, I thought. The drawing was in ink. It was stylized and sparse. It caught the feel and form of partridges, but there was no color or detail in it. I flipped through the book, showed her other drawings, finches, seabirds, thrushes. She ignored them all. Then I showed her the drawing of a pheasant. Her black pupils dilated. She leaned forward and stared down her beak at it, as fascinated as she had been with the partridges. I was amazed that she could understand two-dimensional images. So these animals are expertly designed that they can do that. Now let's skip on. Let's skip on down to when. Let's see. Let's go to page 138, and when she realizes these birds are, you know, something that she can eat. I think we just break in the middle of the top paragraph. Says, "I am bewildered. There is no safety out there, nowhere to hide, unless the pheasant thinks that putting her chicks amongst the distant moorhens would give them a faint statistical chance of escape." She goes, Mabel is baiting at them, baiting so hard, wings beating so furiously that she hangs horizontally in the air. The breeze is cold to my face, my fist pulled towards the fleeing pheasants. She bounces back onto my hand, beak open with exertion, fixes me with a white-hot, angry eye, then baits towards them again. And then this is Helen saying, "Not here, not now. Mabel, I can't let you catch one. It's against the laws of God and man and college." So she goes on, and just remember, her friend is in there. Christina's right there with her, trying to keep all this under control. Down a little bit further towards the bottom of the page, meanwhile, Mabel is standing on tiptoe, jumping up and down, craning her neck over my shoulder to see where they have gone, and I'm trying to stop her from seeing and largely failing. And I turn my head and see Christina running across the field, arms windmilling, and before her, scores of moorhens rushing back into the woods. Wings open as they run, like small boys playing aeroplane. And this is funny. And I start giggling uncontrollably. This is ludicrous. I'm holding tight onto Britain's deadliest hawk while someone chases all the game birds away. She says, "If any of my falconer friends find out about this, they'll never speak to me again." So anyway, I think she's really, really can be funny. And then, anybody have any comments on that? Because I have one last thing then for this final panel. So we've talked a lot about her beautiful writing. Let's go to page 148. And she's on the field with Stuart, and they're trying to figure out when they can start flying Mabel free. In other words, let her off the leather tethers. And she's described something very beautiful that takes place, and it's like it's almost like Stuart was there to help her see it. And I think that also, I think it was her love of nature that really seemed to help her, you know, out of depression. And I know that the clinics that do work with people, and, you know, not everybody that gets depression has the opportunity to go to a health clinic, but usually they try and get them out into nature and get them walking and get them, you know, seeing beautiful things. But it says, she says, I trudge, but this is the top of page 148. She says, "I trudge back to the car, staring down at my feet. Then Stuart stops dead. Stuart? Look," he says, "look at that." "What?" I say, turning and shading my eyes. "I can't see anything." "Look towards the sun." He says, "I am now." He says, "I am now. Look down." Then I see it. The bare field we had flown the hawk upon is covered in a gossamer, millions of shining threads combed downwind across every inch of soil. Lit by the sinking sun, the quivering silk runs like light on water all the way to my feet. It's a thing of unearthly beauty, the work of a million tiny spiders searching for new homes. Each had spun a charged silken thread out into the air to pull it from its hatch place, ascending like an intrepid hot air balloonist to drift and disperse and fall. I stare at the field for a long time. It reminds me of an evening last autumn on my trip to Uzbekistan. I've been sitting on the ground outside my tent, wondering if the terrible smell was a decomposing cow or something much worse. Before me were miles of marsh and desert, and in the far distant of Fergana Mountains fading into the haze. Then I saw the strangest things hang in the air, and I could not work out what they were. They looked like white question marks, and they disobeyed the laws of physics alarmingly. There was no wind at all, yet they hovered and sank and rose with supernatural slowness. He said, I ran after one. I walked up to it so that it was within six inches of my nose, and I still couldn't understand what it was. It was as long as my hand from wrist to finger tip. It was white and squiggly like the doodle you make with a running out pen and made of some material I couldn't identify. I thought of manna and of soda and of ash and silly string, and then I looked very, very closely as it rose very, very slowly upwards, and there from the base of this white frothy squiggle was an almost invisible line, and right at the bottom of the line was a spider exactly this size and the size of the word "ah." And so she is a great naturalist writer, and I do think there's a lot of advantages to the book, and we just hope that you've enjoyed it. And there's some other things we could say. And I think what I'll do is I'll do one final program just with myself, and I'll just give you some final thoughts on the book. And again, we'll just go ahead and plan for one more program. But I do want you to remember that we will begin our discussion of The Piano Shop on the Left Bank, and that is by Thad Carhart, at the end of March. And it might slip into that first week in April now. So please write any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1, and the Twitter comments are coming in, so thank you for those. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature, and please keep liking that page. So until the next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.